Hi everyone. Today I'm talking to Alona Sosunova, a director of engineering at Vinted and the founder of Tech Kinship, a community that strives to unite all and any humans in the tech world towards emotional and professional growth. During our conversation, we talked about software development, mission-driven teams, agile coaching, and diversity and inclusion. Enjoy.
Okay, Alona. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Welcome to the Happy Developer Podcast.
Hey, y'all.
Hey, nice to see you here. So, okay, before we get into any topic in greater depth, it would be great just to know how are you doing lately? What's on your mind right now?
Yeah, so on my mind right now that I'm working from home with kids who is sick. So if somebody runs in suddenly, don't be surprised, it happens.
So what's going on in your life right now? What are the highlights?
So right now we are, I would not say that anymore in kicking off, but more in running Tech Kinship, a new initiative in Lithuania, which address emotional health, as well diversity and inclusion, and all the topics that we usually don't speak about imposter syndrome, about emotions at work, parenting, losses, the feeling that you are never ready to take on the next role, and many other topics, actually, even that some of the people, they don't really enjoy Christmas and how they feel during those. So it's more making okay to talk about bad emotions, good emotions, any emotions, and together found where is that line where it's still acceptable at work and where it's not anymore.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's one of the things I was thinking of discussing with you. And it's great that you started talking about that. But maybe before we jump into this, it would be great to talk about tech in general. And I have a philosophical question to you, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
So you talk relatively extensively about your experience as well on various platforms and in various in television, in various news portals, and that many people already covered a lot of ground with you. So I don't want to go into topics that you already talked a lot about, just not to get you bored too much. But still, I would like to give people some context about you. So you're an interesting case, in my opinion. So you are someone who worked in major tech companies like CSC, now called DXC Technology. You worked at Adform. Now you are a director of engineering at Vinted, right? For those who don't know, Vinted is our first unicorn in Lithuania. We are very proud of that. And it's a big responsibility, I can imagine. Now, the other thing is that, as you also talked in many places, you're not an IT person in that narrow sense.
I am director of engineering without engineering background.
Exactly. You, if I understand correctly, you never studied computer science. You studied political science, right?
Yeah.
But still, you led projects as a project manager. You were a team manager. Now you're a director of engineering. You were, if I understand correctly, as a mentor at Women Go Tech, another initiative that helps women to get into IT, empower them. Now you're one of the co-founders of Tech Kinship, right? So there's a lot of tech in what you're doing. Now, the philosophical question is this. Would you consider yourself a developer?
No.
Why?
The fun thing that, according to Gallup StrengthsFinder, one of my top three strengths is a developer. But I don't consider myself being an engineer. Yes, I am developer of the systems, of the products, but not an engineer, let's say. So it depends how you choose to use word developer. And all my career, I was actually challenged. How can you lead the IT project without IT background, how you can lead engineering team without engineering background. Later on, how can you lead department or organization without engineering background? And of course, there is always a borderline, and there should be a balance. So I understand IT terms. In 10 years in tech, of course, you get acknowledged with them. I can explain architecture on high level. I understand why we are using certain technologies, certain processes, but other best practices. But I never wrote a single line of code myself. And I didn't study that in university. But I do believe that, especially in tech, it's not just about the engineering effort. We have so many extremely talented engineers who are very good in technical concepts. And I do believe that my strength is to create organization which enables them to thrive and to work more efficiently. And as I say, not to disturb them to work.
Exactly.
And I do believe that this strength is not less important, and on a certain level, it becomes even more important than deeply understanding the technology or exact way of implementing certain things.
Mm-hmm. So your short answer was no, but if I interpret it correctly, the long answer is yes. In my understanding,
I'm not an engineer.
Yep. Okay, but let's stop
but
here.
But I do believe that.
But let's stop here, Alana. Don't jump. So what's in your understanding? What's the key difference between an engineer, a software engineer, and a software developer? For me, there is a difference.
I do believe that for every term, you can attach certain meaning, and it doesn't change the concept itself or how you identify yourself. So for me, it's more play of words, honestly, because you can call yourself a software developer and don't have a mindset of developing the product, organization, and so on. And you can be called software engineer. And call yourself an engineer and have all of that.
So great. So because in my understanding, you are a software developer, and the meaning that I attach to this word is a person who participates in the software development process. And I think that it's also a topic that is very related to the idea of diversity. You talked about inclusion in the context of techinship. And, you know, I had a conversation with one of my friends, past clients, Thomas Patras Rupchis at Wix right now. And he made me cry during this conversation. And the way he did it is when we were discussing, let's say, different ways how people contribute to the tech area. And I told him that I was working as a counselor and that the majority of my clients are in tech. In the past, I worked as an IT recruiter, so I had to understand what it's like to be a DevOps engineer, what it's like to be a project manager, what it's like to be an agile consultant, so that I would be able to, one, identify these profiles, and second, be able to build a relationship with these people by using those concepts that you mentioned and show that I have at least some understanding about these things. And the way he made me cry is then he told me that one of the core problems in software development is naming things. And people like you, for example, those people who are said to be working on the high level, which also is a strange thing, you know, they are experts at naming things, identifying problems, talking about these problems, whether it's technical problems, emotional problems. And you said that, in my view, you are a software developer. And that made me cry for some reason, because I never saw myself as, like you maybe said that, not a developer. But now I think, fuck it. Maybe I am. Maybe in some sense I am. And maybe in some sense you are. So what would be your take on that?
The word I am using is creator. So you either are
same
part of creating the things or not. And maybe for me, just the word developer is overused in so many concepts. that I don't see that bigger picture anymore of it, because it's just maybe used too much. On the other hand, I don't like, actually, I don't like any of the wording, neither programmer nor developer nor engineer, because at the end of the day, it's still about the meaning that we attach to this word.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yeah, I mean, so on a practical level, maybe it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, you have to achieve a certain result. How you name certain things, whether it's programmer, developer, maybe it's not the most important thing. Although, you know, to be honest with you, there are many organizations who are going through restructurizations right now, changing organizational structure, changing responsibilities, changing titles. And people do attach a lot of meaning to those titles. Maybe for you, it's not that important, but for people who carry that title, it is. And I guess that's also one of the problems that we might get into, is the identity problem, because people do identify themselves with what they do, you know. And maybe for someone who hears that, okay, it doesn't matter who are you, programmer, engineer, developer, the person might have difference of opinion in this. And but nevertheless, speaking of that idea of developer or creator, okay, so Alana considers herself a creator. And what do you think is the most difficult problem right now you are dealing with as a creator?
Actually, one of more interesting problems, maybe it's not the major ones, but I do believe that the concept of super stable teams, which are going through the stages of storming, norming, performing, and it usually takes, according to the literature, from 2 to 5 months, and that you should aim to keep them stable and long-lived, like forever. It's not something which is reflecting nowadays realities anymore. On the other hand, we're so used to this concept that it's very hard for us to let it go and go away from that. And that sometimes those teams, long-lived teams, they actually become like families, like very close communities, which very hardly let someone in or let someone out. And this is not becoming, this is very nice, but sometimes it's becoming a thing which is not helping you to perform, but on the opposite, which makes organizational growth and the fast implementation of the strategy and competition harder.
I guess you're getting into the topic of mission-driven teams we talked about previously when we met, right?
Overall, I think that nowadays we live in the environment where we should learn how to work efficiently within our organization, our culture, with the fast building track of trust.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot let ourselves build teams or trust within the teams for 2-5 months anymore. It's simply not realistic, because then it slows down a big organization when you want to scale a lot. On the other hand, it's very important to have to let specialists grow within the domain, not just I do believe that back and front and engineer, which is thrown from one team to another, from one scope to another, without getting deep exercise in one domain as well, doesn't really help neither for organization nor the person. And then the whole concept, how we change the teams, how we project personal growth, it's simply changing recently. And part of that is the solution, or maybe the way where I would like to go is mission-driven teams. Mm-hmm. but more overall dynamic reteaming process that maybe the team you are belonging to is not anymore the core concept we're building organizations around. We're building them not around the teams, but we are building them around the vision and mission where our organization wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that team concept, that it should be very long-lived, very stable. It seems like it comes from Agile, but in reality, if you dig into this more, it doesn't. It's not stated anywhere, but it somehow became a concept which is... which became value itself. But I think that nowadays it doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah, I think that it's also tied to the idea of commitment, that a person has to be like committed for many years to the organization, for organization to flourish. And then if we have a lot of turnover, a lot of attrition, then it's impossible to grow. And I think it's also one of those assumptions that maybe are made in this particular context. Now, if you allow me to push back a little bit, I guess it's important to identify the framework or context where we are coming from, because I guess in product-driven organizations where you are working maybe on a particular maybe marketplace, let's say like Vinted, maybe it indeed seems that team is like a core constituent that we build our organizational structure around. But for example, in, let's say, project-driven teams that might be working on maybe 3-4 projects at the same time, especially in those smaller agencies where maybe there's less buzz and it's just, you have to get the work done and, you know, and you do it the way you do it, you know, and there, some engineers do indeed emphasize this frustration that they are put from one team to another, and there's difficult to build that trust in a very short time, and it's also difficult to get into the new product, especially there's a lot of legacy. So that switching between projects, you know, it's one of the key frustrations among software developers. And now I would just like to get your thinking around that. So what do you think would be a good way, on the one hand, to be flexible and dynamic and to be able to create that trust as fast as possible, but at the same time, overcome this challenge of basically making people unproductive in a way? What do you think?
So maybe what's the difference between project-based organization and project-driven teams and mission-driven teams? So mission for me is a kind of the domain which you are trying to improve, and you become an expert of this domain. For example, domain could be search. So basically, in whatever mission you go as search expert, as a search engineer, meaning who knows the technology, who knows how to solve that exact problem. And you are improving your domain, but you can improve that in multiple initiatives and way.
Not necessarily instead, with coding, for example, in many different ways.
It could be. It could be with architecturing or consulting other teams.
Got
or being data scientist or designer. So it doesn't matter in which role you are. But more that you are an expert of the mission of improving, for example, of solving certain problems of the customer. And then there could be multiple initiatives related to that, but you always are acting as an expert of that domain. And that's the core difference, that you're still having one big context in your mind and one core domain. And of course, it's harder maybe when you're implementing different projects for the clients, for example, and it could be harder applicable. But when you are creating your own product and evolving that, you're still focusing on the single part of the product. You're not switching the context for many different, that one day you're a search expert, another day, I know, some security one, third day, something else, because it's lots of context then become like, they should be exploding your brains, especially when you have to switch through the very different content. And on top of that, even though that we have one bigger domain area of expertise and bigger mission, that we are still creating virtual teams within that. And then as an engineer, you focus on single things instead of having backlog as a team of, I don't know, of 10 topics and switching during the planning, implementations, and so on through 10 different topics. You focus just on one. And that's as well correlates with the such values as focus and stop starting, start finishing things. So basically you are iterating and working on one mission, and mission can last for a month or it can last for 2 years. So basically it really depends from the mission size, but mission is always oriented around not end goal as a project. The end scope is this one, implement that one. No, it's about the customer problem. So basically your mission is to solve the problem, but not to very clearly define the scope and say like, these are the tasks, please implement them. Mm-hmm. And that's as well a difference that you are creating and acting as developer or creator of the solution, which actually solves the customer problem or organization problem and let you iterate many times and be on the mission, but within one context, and with growing within one area, start to love what you're doing and become as an expert, stronger and stronger, different, maybe seeing different angles of the same thing, but still working on the related missions, not being thrown to very different scopes. While in project-based organization, the context could be completely different. That's one thing. That one day you can be search engineer and another day you may become privacy engineer. Mm-hmm. And you have, if you work on 3 or 4 scopes and in parallel, it should be like really hard to switch the focus. Another thing that in projects you have very clear scope defined and end goal and when it's finished. While in mission, when you're developing certain part of the product, it's quite ongoing. It's quite long way to go and long mission to go, an ambitious one. So there is quite a difference. On the other hand, I do believe that if you say that I want to work in certain team, which for example, usually it has front-end engineers, we have back-end engineers, we have design, we have DSA, product manager, team lead, and we say we want to make everything in certain team, then what happens that you realize that for certain implementation you need a ML engineer and you have one. So what do? You say, okay, we will not do that scope, we don't have that person, or we hire him into the team and then there is a problem. Oh, we don't have work for front end, so front end, please figure out what you do for a month. Then later on, we will have work for you, and they go and do something else. And then we have not neither effective organization. And I think that one of the worst thing for engineers is to feel that they don't really have what to do, or they have to figure out on their own what to do. And that's super demotivating. While if we work more in some domains or dynamic reteaming model, we will always have what to do. Because we can open up new missions. We can say that in this team we need ML and backend. In this one, maybe we need to double down on the front end engineers. And then you have, as an organization, much more flexibility on the tactical level, still retaining some of the boundaries and context, which will not affect a person's, I would say, brain capacity to work on very different and lots of context.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So in a way, I'm not sure if I will be able to pick every benefit, but several benefits that popped into my mind when we were talking is, one of the benefits is that you have this flexibility. So in a mission-driven team, essentially, you are able to switch resources. I understand that a resource is a bad word.
Maybe
a competencies. So for example, if you have an ML or machine learning engineer in a one team, and maybe that team is missing, maybe you can share that person. And if the person is able to build trust.
Not share. It's a rule of thumb that you can work on single mission at the single time. So meaning sharing between two teams, it's not going to happen. So you belong to one mission then. But the difference maybe within one, let's say, so is manager-driven team. So meaning the team is the one manager manages. And another one is more self-selecting. So we say that on that mission, we need certain expertise. And then even the people coming to that mission can tell whether they can contribute or not. And aware that during some planning process, we said most probably we will need search engineers there, but during the planning process, they said, no, we don't have what to do there. We go to another mission.
Exactly.
And that
this is where I was getting. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's basically people themselves can partially choose and say whether they can contribute for these strengths or not. That's one thing. And on the another hand, it's exactly prevent us from sharing people in terms of that they 50% of the time work on one thing and 50% of the time on another. And then the entity, which we say that we believe we belong, is not anymore a team. It's more subdomain or domain that you're working on.
So essentially, it's not that a person is working at, like in a project concept, a context on different projects at the same time. It's just that if, for example, a person solved one's mission, the person can go to a different problem. And it doesn't mean that the person has to work as the ML engineer forever in the same team. Yep. So I guess that's okay. So that's one of the benefits. Another benefit I think you mentioned is that, at least maybe directed to, is that when a person is focused on a mission, there's more room for creativity, I guess, because when you're just assigned to do tasks, your mission is to do a task. But if your job is to work on a mission, so it's a much more broader context and you can look at the problem from very different angles and contribute in very different ways. And I guess I can imagine that an ML engineer, maybe the person's expertise is machine learning, artificial intelligence, but maybe there are other ways how the person can contribute to the mission. And the person, I can imagine, is empowered to contribute also with other skills as well, if the person has them.
Yep. For me, there is always, it's a tricky question. Like, of course, everybody has their opinion, for example, on design matter, what design we should choose. But then I think that currently in the market, in some of the companies and some of the teams, not at all of them, of course, we got into the situation where there is a Lithuanian song, like we are all designers. So basically that every team member's opinion on every matter is treated as the same voice, let's say. So like each, if we vote for design, we have 10 people and there's voting, and actually the design is provided by user experience specialist, right? And he's an expert in that, and then his voice is treated equally to five engineers' voice, like 5-1. Oops, you lost. Go and do another design.
Yeah, but Alona, if you allow me to interrupt, that I think that's a different thing. So one is opinion. For me, opinion is not expertise. It's just some output that can be based on opinion, anecdotes, maybe some idea how it should look like, and then it's expertise. And if, let's say, an ML engineer is also a strong architect when it comes to building architecture, and the person is aware of different principles, how a system might look like for solving that particular problem. So there is expertise. Now, what you're getting at, I think it's like the problem of democracy where people just start like voting. And I think it's not the,
yeah,
the thing we're talking about.
Yeah. So yes to what you say.
Okay.
And no, and catch yourself within the teams, because in many soft cultures where it's big inclusion culture, and where we want to include everybody,
mm-hmm.
we slip that line and we go into democracy, diminishing expertise. And I think that lots of things, lots of the teams have to catch themselves if they are doing that, because it's so easy to do and have opinion on everything, especially when you are for a long time on the mission. Because when you're getting a task, it's harder to do that. But when you are in 2 years listening for user researches and so on, it's so easy to delete that line when everybody has opinion on everything, because we have lots of content, lots of history. Then it's very important to still remember who owns accountability for the decision, and let that person be the one who is at the end. We can disagree and still come in.
But now that's another problem. I'm not sure if you are aware, but you hinted to it, that when you have a traditional team, like maybe a long-term team, you get into the problem of too much expertise, where a person is too much ingrained into the project. The person knows too much. And the fact that the person knows too much makes the person too biased, because the person listens so long to the client's problems that the person feels that he or she is the expert, or they are the experts. And in a mission-driven team, in a way, you kind of reduce this, because people are more on an equal page. And then it's not the case of how much of experience you have in a particular domain or mission-driven team. The thing is, how are you able to argue or provide solution to a particular problem? And I think that argument of authority is also a problem that we face into these discussions when it comes to finding for solutions. And many junior developers, I have some in my counseling practice, they're so fearful to say something that, you know, then you get into HR people looking for systematic ways to solve this. And then they say, oh no, we have to listen to everyone. But then it doesn't matter what the person has to say, because maybe some junior developer indeed doesn't have to say, and another junior developer does have to say something. So working on this problem, Alana, right now, so what could be like a more flexible way to include people in these mission-driven teams, where on the one hand, you focus on expertise, focus on competence, but at the same time, you don't push down creativity, you don't push down new ideas, new original thinking. Some maybe junior person might not have domain experience, but the person might provide a very good theoretical solution that can also work if it can be tuned by experts. So what could be like the middle ground in this? What do you think?
I believe that there is no... It's not about mission-driven teams or stable teams. It's more about the culture, mm-hmm. And about our beliefs. I do believe that very stable teams, in some, as you mentioned, in some period of their lifetime, they reach stagnation. And then a little bit changing either the scope or team composition, it really helps. Just usually we're changing just in one way. It's like moving one person to another team or adding new person to the team. On the other hand, what, for example, we did lately, we pulled everybody back to one single big team. And based
one
on
pool.
Mission, yeah, one pool. And then based on mission, adding on top people's preferences and expertise, we form much smaller teams. So if usual engineering team is around 10 people, 10, 12, with all the... data or business analytics, product manager, if we count all the roles, it's usually around 10 people. So virtual teams can be 3 or 4 if they don't need, for example, some of the capabilities. So it's not really about the way you structure,
yeah,
but it's more about the culture which you introduce and agreements, because I do believe that it's important to voice upfront that we listen to everybody, but we account on expertise and give feedback for people. Because yes, as you mentioned, there are less experienced engineers in one field, but they're very talented, for example, in user insights or something else, knowing each other's strengths and asking, pulling for those strengths. I even know some of the engineers who are super silent. Super. It's so hard to, I don't know, make them say anything, but they start to talk in one particular point of time when they disagree. Mm. And if you make this, and then on the one hand, it may sound that they are always negative.
Yeah, exactly.
That they just disagree. On the other hand, if you know this about that personality, then we reach the point when that person speaks up, everybody is so still and everybody listens for every word because the person stated that. There are so many people who talk. So when I agree, I'm silent. But when I disagree, then I talk. And then you don't treat anymore that person as negative. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are people who take lots of room, let's say so. Then even giving the feedback that we got it, and explaining why you're not talking straight to the point, but do the eye rolling, it's as well not a healthy one. So it's more for me about the team dynamics and about talking very honestly to each other, mm-hmm. how much room you take, and what is the volume you are playing? Is it too silent or too low, too much, too loud? And especially with the senior person, for mm-hmm. me, the senior person is not the one who dictates, but the one who is able as well to grow and to listen exactly. to others. And that for me is true seniority. Mm-hmm. So none of the compositions can solve this problem alone by creating some kind of the system.
Yeah, I mean, you're also hitting a nail on another problem, I guess, and it's the process. I'm not sure if there's a term for that, but I think it's a process fetish, where we try to think that a process will somehow solve everything. We will go through a agile transformation, we will put teams, you know, in a certain compositions, and then for some reason somehow everything will be solved just because the process somehow makes one's magic, you know. And what you're getting at is that okay, processes or techniques or tools are important, but important is also the team culture. We already talked about building trust. We talked about being able to listen to people and providing space. We talked about also about understanding your teammates and realizing that just because one is, disagreeing doesn't mean that the person is disagreeing to everything, you know. So there's a lot of place for understanding, for compassion, for empathy. Now, the question is how to create that. You know, what can we do to, in a way, provide this psychological safety? You know, I once thought that agile coaches might work on that. But those I talk to, I noticed that there's still a lot of focus on the processes. And I once wrote about that there are like agile coaches and agile coaches. And I think there are too many agile coaches who are experts in the process, experts in the philosophy, experts in the way how to do things, but they're less comfortable about working on that team dynamics aspect, about getting to know people, understanding their phenomenology or subjective experience. That's, you know, no, we are experts on the process, and our job is to make sure that the process creates value to the company. And they are like more trainers than coaches. But now, for example, you are also someone who is trained a bit in coaching, in that modern coaching, and the idea that facilitating thinking, providing space for thinking, providing space for feelings. I think Tech Kinship does similar things. So just help me help me leave this kingdom of mirrors, because in my biased world, it seems that the bias is towards the process. But I would like to believe that more and more agile coaches are going to the different direction. So I guess that's a good point to talk about agile. What would be your take on that dichotomy, process versus team dynamics?
As ex-agile coach, the most hated word for me is agile. I try not to use it at all.
And the term agile coach, is agile the most hated word? Why?
Term agile, because... for me, agile is a noun, so meaning it's written from the small word. When we say agile, it's like a building or a framework.
From capital A.
And, from capital A. So this, in the agility for me, it's like truly the flexibility of organization and the ability to adapt and the same for the team. I don't believe that every team needs to do Scrum or shouldn't do. And I do agree with some of the agile coaches and consulting saying that any framework is just a starting point, because then you have to evolve and create yourself. And what we usually forget, it's why we're doing things in a certain way. When I used to be agile consultant, so I come to the teams and they're doing certain things and I'm asking why. So do you know what's the idea behind that? And people cannot explain. They know what they have to do according to the framework.
Yeah.
They cannot explain me why. What's the whole idea of story point? They cannot explain why. What's the idea of daily standard at all?
But you know, if to allow me to push back a bit, if you allow me to use a metaphor, if I asked my clients, let's say it's a metaphor, I'm a psychologist. So if I had to ask my client, in this case, not a team, but an individual person, why the person is responding to mirroring, why the person is responding to my empathy, why I'm asking certain questions and not other questions. So that's like a back, and that's the methodology that we as, you know, experts try to use to help the person. And it's an interesting question if a person has to understand what is going on, like on under the, you know, under the roof, under the, in the back end, you know, of the system. And the way you argue, it seems that the team should understand why they use certain methodology, but maybe they shouldn't.
In my personal opinion, they should, because the why is the core thing. What we aim to achieve with certain every single meeting process. Otherwise, let's not do that, because we all know that meetings overall, we don't like them. It's a waste of time. And actually, if we just do them for the sake of doing them, it's much better not to do them at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that exactly in the way teams work, we should be very conscious about why we do every step. But it's the same in the engineering and developing the system. You're asking yourself, like, can you cut this part if you don't need that? So it's the same with the processes, because it's so easy to make such a heavy weighted process for a team to kill it almost. So in this particular context, it's very important that agile coach not just work with the putting in place the system, but explaining each of the parts and why we do that, so that people could understand. And you can do that both ways. So one way is to establish the process and say, like, just do that. Trust me, I know what I'm doing. And with some of the team, it's faster approach, but still you explain them why you think. And then later on, you iterate on that. But another, I would say, bad thing, it's when agile coaches become like coaches.
Coaches in what sense? Explain the term.
Coaches in what sense? Like, when you're coaching the person to find the answers where you actually should act as an expert and tell those answers. So coaching could be when in the places where the person is capable to come up with the answer in the decent amount of time. But when people ask how we should estimate, and a coach asks, so what do you think how you should estimate, when people have no clue and no knowledge about the framework. So it's simply where by the book, by the framework, it should work. How do you think why it's not working? Like, you tell me, you're an expert of the framework. So sometimes when you go too much into the coaching manner,
but that's not coaching, Alana.
It's called coaching. Yeah, exactly. But it's called coaching in our culture. And that's the bad thing about coaching, because even notice, so now you coach me, and coach me means that you brainwash me.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that neither. But if you go to and do the corridor test.
But did you do research on that?
I did many corridor tests, actually talking to people. And the most hated word is coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Because coaching usually is, I'm going to coach you. And coach you meaning that with the questions, I will lead you to the answer which I want you to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we spoiled coaching overall. And it's very hard for people to believe in coaches who are actually more partner of the conversations, helping you to come up with the answer yourself without any opinion from what is real coaching is, but instead without knowing what coaching is, people call themselves coaches and lead you to some certain answer, yeah. And you feel that you are manipulated.
Indeed.
And some of the agile coaches do that. And I experienced that myself and some of the interactions, yeah, with different organizations and different experts. And then it doesn't feel like coaching. It feels like, can you just save my time and tell me the answer you want me to tell you?
It's psychopathy. So this is the problem I wanted to talk to you, because I see you also as an agile professional, once was an agile consultant, if I understand correctly. So let me pick my brains on that. So, and I think it's a good way to define terms. So there is there's that. In my estimation, there's an agile trainer or consultant. So that's the person who knows why to do things, how to do things. That's the person who understands the framework or the variety of frameworks. That's the person who realizes what framework might be suitable for a particular purpose. That's also the person who is able to ask those questions. So why guys are you guys? Okay, that's a bad term right now, but nevertheless, why people you are using Scrum, why are you using XP or whatever, you know? But still, it's a trainer, you know, it's a consultant. And I feel that those people who are trained as consultants or trainers, they should keep consulting and training. Now, because market is changing and the word coaching is due to International Coaching Federation standards, it's becoming a different thing. It's not about consulting. It's not about training. It's not about providing knowledge. It's not about even sometimes facilitating knowledge. It's about being a thinking partner in a way what certain psychotherapists do. But now, okay, some agile coaches now who call themselves coaches, they see this trend. I'm just psychoanalyzing. I don't have research, but I'm just psychoanalyzing. They see, okay, so I should be also a coach. But I am a coach because I call myself a coach for 10 years. So I should do coaching because I am a coach. And then they get on a short Udemy course about how to coach teams. Oh, so that's about asking questions. I can ask questions. Oh, that's about providing feedback. I can provide feedback. And then you get into the situations where you ask a question. So why do you think this framework is wrong? No, I didn't say that. You said that. Why do you think it's wrong? So tell me, as you said. And you know, the problem is that it's a difficult thing to coach or have a proper conversation where you are able to mirror what the person said. You are helping the person from their internal knowledge, internal resources, come up with a solution, come up with an idea. It's time consuming as well. It's difficult to do that like in 20 minutes. You can do that in 30 minutes, but still it can take time. And also the person might be in anxiety, in stress, and then you have some mental health experience. So that's why I guess I was trying to define the difference between an agile coach and agile trainer. And for me, when agile coaches are trainers, that's fine for me. But when they are becoming agile coaches without the coaching expertise, I think that's a different problem. Now, the different question is, would I like to agile coaches to be coaches in that modern sense? Yes, I do. And I think this is what they need to create facilitate those mission-driven teams, because without that, you won't be able to facilitate trust. You will facilitate some artificial thing. What do you think?
I agree with you from what I see in the market. Like out of 10 coaches, maybe one has coaching expertise, like real expertise, as a coaching in that ICF, for example, defined way. And my personal story is I used to be agile coach and have that title. But then when I went to like real ICF courses and did all those tens of hours of coaching, training and later on practices, I realized that I was a very bad coach in terms of coaching, because it was not coaching, it was coaching you to the certain, because the coaching starts itself from the position that you don't know the answer, and that you're open to hear any, and that you don't want to direct person to certain answer. When it's agile coach, I think that it would be better, because it's coach in terms of trainer, of coach, like a team coach, as a sport, from the terminology what comes from sports, but not which comes from actually coaching like a methodology or in ICF defined terms, for example. And I do believe that even how those terms came up, where history of the world is completely different, but it sounds the same, looks like the same, and then you're very often attached to the same meaning. And it's super rare case when you can expect like real coaching from the agile coach, where he or she is an expert in, because they don't invest so much into coaching expertise.
Why? They should, it seems.
They should, but even, you know, those who, for me, coaching is...
Why, sorry, Alena, why did you invest? Because I understand that you are now a director of engineering at, it's like a competency that a high-level executive should have and oftentimes
actually,
have.
I went to study coaching for very simple reasons. I catched myself that I know too many answers up front. And I exactly went to those to that journey to unlearn knowing the answers and to unlearn biasing people. Because if you are a manager or a leader, whoever, and manager is not actually a bad word in this term, because I think that it's wrong that we are afraid to use it anymore. But when you are a manager and you know many answers upfront, you are a shitty manager. For senior people especially. Maybe for junior it's a better one, but for senior experts it's a very bad thing if you know the answers upfront. And actually it narrows down as well your creativity and the things which you can achieve. And that's why I studied coaching, and I did all those exercises, and for me it was sometimes it's so hard. And even now through the my one-on-one, we always agree what session you want it to be. Should it be me as your manager and you, or is it a coaching session? Because if it's a coaching session, I'm not your manager anymore. Because if I have a hat of my manager, I have to direct you to some answers.
But that's an assumption, you know. You don't have to.
Not actually, because...
You don't have to. That's not being a manager. I think it's a... matter of taste, but if you allow me to like put a diagram, for me a manager is a manager, that it is what it is, and then you have different hats, and one hat is to be a expert where you provide guidance, one hat is maybe a coach where you just listen and provide space. And in my understanding, manager, you know, just because someone is not qualified as a coach and maybe is not an expert doesn't mean that the person is not a manager. The person is a manager that uses different competencies.
Let's discuss the case.
Okay.
Employee comes to you, and you have a team.
Maybe
leading,
it comes
right?
to you because I'm not a manager.
Yeah, okay. Employee comes to me, and I have a team of 10 people, leaders I am managing. And we are discussing that person is particularly mad on another person from the team, they have a conflict. We're digging into why. So I'm trying to do that in a coaching style without any, I don't know, just from the curiosity, being curious, be the coaching partner. And then that person is telling me what he or she's planning to do, what kind of conversation to have, like today, later on. And I see that it will be bad
if disaster.
The person leaves that room and still goes and have that conversation. There will be collateral damage which we can like avoid. And as a coach immediately in that part, in my mind, even though that I'm still trying to coach, I already have a big interest to prevent that conversation because it affects me, it affects the team, it affects the relationship between those two persons. And that immediately, that moment, I stop becoming a coach. Because simply, then my answer, you should not do that. Why? I can tell you why. And of course, when I see that we have one-on-one for 1 hour, 10 minutes left, that person still has opinion that go and fight. And I know that the plan is go and fight like 1 hour after the meeting. So no time to go and produce. Then I have to prevent some of the action simply and say like...
Okay, I get the point. And basically, if I understand you correctly, the thing you're getting at is that there are certain situations where for the manager, it's important to prevent certain outcomes. And I totally feel you on this. Now, in some interview, you said that one of the important things that a manager should be able to do is allow people to fail. And sometimes really, really fail. And you know, if I will still push back a little bit. So if you're that manager, you know, that person who is listening to the person's idea of how the conflict should be resolved, right? And you feel that, oh boy, or oh girl, that might be disastrous. In my experience, that didn't seem to work. And I feel that it can be the same in your situation, but I'm not sure because I'm a biased person. My experience might not be your experience, but this is how I see. What do you think about that?
I believe that there should be a balance.
So, but like, look, yeah, just to finish. So this would be an example of what I do as a coach, because for me as a coach, it's okay to share guidance as long as it's contracted with a client. And if the client expects to understand certain things, let's say understand the difference between depression or anxiety, the person feels that it's important to hear my side of the story, how I went through a certain experience, it's allowed to do that. And in those introductory courses, newbie coaches are forbidden to do that because you can make mistakes. But when you are on a more expert level, it's okay to do that. And I think managers especially should be empowered to do that because it's their experience. This is what people are coming for. Now, the question is how you are providing this experience. And if you are just trying to nail with a hammer on that and don't do that, that will be wrong. You will fail. And if the person is disagreeable, the person might transfer that, okay, now you're being my mother and you're forbidding me to do something. I will do that because I want to be a disagreeable child, you know. So, and if you're just keeping that distance from a coaching perspective, sharing that experience but not forcing it, it's still coaching in my understanding. It's coaching and being a good manager. But maybe I'm wrong.
But yes and no. For me, it's like I do believe that in managerial, when you are a manager, coaching is just one tool that you have.
Yeah, totally.
You have many others, right? And that to use that to ensure that people don't get defensive of you using that, you should name that. That it's for me, in my experience, much easier than we say like, because expectations towards the manager and coach, they differ.
But look, Alena, why you as a manager should call it a coaching? It's just a conversation. And the problem is when this style is not natural to you, if you're used to giving advice all day, every day, and then suddenly you come from training and you start talking as a psychotherapist, of course, a person will be defensive. But if it's your natural way of problem solving, just being patient, not forcing anything, but still providing guidance in a relaxed, calm way, maybe even an emotional way, because it's also some form of your being, you know, but you're still provide that space. You're not dominating the conversation. I think it's still coaching in the sense it's still a way how you have conversations. And I think you can have that full-fledged coaching where you don't give answers in a coaching style, mm-hmm. but you can also provide advice, help, and guide person step-by-step also in a coaching style that it's not dominating the whole conversation. And
you can, but not with the people who have experience with the coach.
But coaches, because, you mean?
Yep.
Like not in
because,
the true sense.
Yep. But, why? Because those people, they are allergical for the way when you start asking questions, because they immediately feel unsafe and they immediately feel that you try to guide them somewhere. And they stop thinking and they start to be defensive. So if people had interaction with coaches, which actually are more manipulators, as they call them, meaning who guide you to some particular, yeah. and many people in Lithuania, fucking so many, had such experience that with these people, the only thing which works for me is telling that now I will be in a coaching mode. I will be asking questions. I will have no opinion. And I will like more, I will have opinion when you ask me, but let's just try to figure out what's bothering you. And for me, that was the thing which helped me to build relationship. And now, as you mentioned, maybe having that introduced into our conversation without being pushed back, because people feel safe with me, that they know that if I'm asking, it's not because I want to guide them somewhere.
But we're not disagreeing, Alona. We're not disagreeing, because what you describe is like the core contracting. You don't do things without the consent of the other person. And the way you describe it is that, okay, now I would like to use a different conversation style. I explain this. Let's say you get that pushback. You're curious. You try to learn, okay, what's going on? Because I see that you're skeptical. And the person says, oh, because I had this awful experience and I don't want to guide me somewhere. And now you say, oh, wow, because I was not thinking of doing that. So, and then you build that ground, and maybe next time the person, as you said, will be much safer. So I guess the problem you're mentioning is that two problems, maybe one, when managers feel that they have to talk in a coaching manner in every single way. So that's one problem every single time. Another problem is when managers feel that they don't have to explain because they are afraid to explain what they are doing in the conversation. That's another problem. And I think if you are curious about the person's bad experience with coaching and you're trying to contract maybe a different hat, and I think the same is with giving advice. It's strange that we don't contract this, because maybe the person doesn't want your advice, but you are pushing it because you want to feel expert.
And actually, that's exactly the problem with many agile coaches, that they're coaching in Lithuanian, it would be auklėja, but it's like...
Nurture, I think it's
nurture. Not nurture, but it's like when you talk to your kid, like, you shouldn't behave like this. They do that with the questions. Like, do you think that it fosters healthy team dynamics, such your behavior? What can you answer to that question?
Opinion.
Do you believe that working like that will help you to achieve better results? And the question itself coming, like, why do you think that what I propose is wrong and what you propose is right? So it's in questions, but they either close, they're more statements, or they are the questions which ask you to defend yourself and your opinion. And this is not that they do that from bad intent, but they are taught in few hours trainings to ask questions. And it's so hard when you're an expert and trainer and you actually know how to do the things, not to be on the one side. They are placed with all, I would say, trainings of agile coaches. They are pushed in very bad position. On one side, they are an expert. On the other hand, they say you cannot be pushy and you cannot tell people what
binary thinking.
Yep, you should help them to come up with that idea. But sometimes, how the hell I can come up with the idea I never knew existed? Like, if I always ride a bicycle, how can I tell you what kind of car I want? I never used a car in my life, and then I expect you to be. And in one organization, I was consulting one organization, and they said, like, we need to talk to you. And like, yeah, but you have your son, idol coach. Why don't you talk to him or her? And they like, because they are telling us the theory, I ask how to solve this problem. They say, you can solve this this way or that way or that way or this way. How do you think? Which one is the best for you? And people say, like, after this conversation, we leave more puzzled than before that.
That's not that bad.
Yeah. But
that's not that bad.
It's not that bad if you're solving your personal problem, right?
Okay.
But if you need a fast medicine, like if you go to the doctor because you have some dysfunction and headache, and they say, you can use this medicine or this day or this one, how do you think which one is the best for you?
But you know, agile is not medicine and never be.
But to some of the dysfunctions, it gives you tools to at least start addressing them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's a tool to, of course, with all of that, overall, with agile, lean, doesn't matter, whatever you use, it can be freestyle. But all the processes, they are designed to solve some of the problem. They're not designed to be in place just to be in place. Otherwise, let's not have them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's we're still, I think, leaning on the idea that problem-solving tools and then working with the psychological stuff. And I think what I'm taking from what you're describing, there's always the balance. And then there's always the question of what the customer or client needs. And I think that there are circumstances where you just have to provide ibuprofen. And if that's the case, we can do that. But ibuprofen, it's still just a pain relief. It will not solve the problem. And I think it's important that our customers would understand that, okay, now what I'll be providing, it will be pain relief, but it will not solve the problem. Is it okay for you? And maybe some client will say, yes, it's okay for me. But then another client might say, no, we want to solve the problem. And then, okay, okay, people. So then the procedure is different. And it's not only about problem solving, about technique. Now we are talking about wishy-washy, about trust, about safety, about educating managers, about all that interesting stuff, at least for me, you know.
But I disagree with you.
Go ahead.
Even with a psychotherapy, when the person comes in bad situation, first thing you do is stabilize him or her.
Now,
only after that you start working with him.
Okay, but that's also an assumption that some clients, they come in pain. Let's say they are in stress, they are panicky, they are in grief. So my job is not to jump into doing something on them. My job first is to try listen on the one hand, and then try to explain what is going on with them, why they might be feeling the way they are feeling. And then I try to contract, okay, look, so there's a quick solution and then there's a long solution. Both are okay. Now, what do you think might work for you? I feel it this, but I want to know what you think. And some clients will tell that, oh, it's just I'm on PMS. I mean, I'm just feeling bad right now and might be panicky, but it will pass. It passed many times, so it's just a stage. I already feel that I'm feeling better when I'm talking to you. We can work on a long-term solution. So the problem, what many psychotherapists do, they believe that they know what is better for a customer. But in my ideological thinking, biased thinking, it's always important to include the client. And I think that this idea works in every situation. We just try to explain what you're thinking of doing and just getting the consent of the person, what they would like to do. And if, let's say, they want ibuprofen, they want that quick mindfulness, we will do quick mindfulness. If they want something else and they okay with that, so I try to respect that because they are adult people, you know. So, but, you know, I'm not a clinical psychologist. Maybe a clinician would say, I'm a doctor and I will treat you. but I'm not a doctor, so I cannot take this role. So.
Yeah, but teams are not, even though that we say like each team has to decide, team at the end of the day, all the organization, they are established to deliver some value. And if I see dysfunctional team, sometimes we don't feel that we have a luxury to give team to decide. Do you want to stay dysfunctional and work on the essence of that for half a year? Or should we fix that faster? Like, no, you don't have, because it's money, it's a product, it's your reputation, it can be many things. Because team at the end of the day, or the person within the organization who is not capable to deliver or can even do the harm, it's not anymore your personal will. If you are a team lead and or a director and you are like feeling super bad, you should either do something with that or not to work, because simply you are making an impact to lots of people. Or if you are an engineer developer on some critical part of the system, which may result in like ending up the company. So for me, that's, it's a little bit different, that first of all, you need to stabilize the team and to assure that they can do first steps and then, of course, build on top of that. So sometimes it's not the discussion. You can have that with mature team who has some of the dysfunctions. But if the, it depends on the situation criticality, as always, on the context, of course. But I do believe that for agile coaches, for managers, for even senior engineers, it's very hard nowadays when any direct leading or telling what to do is overall treated as evil, and that you are micromanager, and you are like you are control freak, whatever. So everybody tries to delegate and coach in terms of like direct people to some level of consciousness without just telling them very openly. And then it frustrates people, because every person, even who's not an expert and never studied anything, feel when he is manipulated towards some of the answers.
Yeah, but Alena, we already, I think, covered this, that we're not trying to find the one solution. It's binary thinking. It's like, okay, now I'm being fully coach, or I'm being fully manager. It's, we're looking for something in the middle. I think that what we agreed on is that you have to be able, in certain circumstances, be a coach, and in circumstances, as you said, to be a manager. And, you know, just because certain people believe that now they have to use this particular solution for every single case, that's also a problem, you know, and yeah, it doesn't have to be that way. And, you know, and I still think that we are not disagreeing, because I think that when you are talking about teams, you know, usually when a team coach is hired, the first person you're talking is not the team. It's usually maybe the manager, it can be also an HR. And this is where I'm explaining, this is where I'm contracting and saying that, look, we can do that ibuprofen or quick solution, but here are the possible consequences. As you mentioned, that people can, for example, if there is bullying and we are not addressing bullying, it will have consequences. If there are problems with delivery, you will have problems with your customer. Possibly. We are not experts. Possibly, right? And still, you provide space for the customer to make the decision and take responsibility. And if we are taking this, you know, maybe it's my value, you know, personal responsibility. If we are putting ourselves into a father or mother figure when we are coaches, consultants, or whatever, we're not talking to adults anymore. We're doing something else. And I still think that doctors are doctors, and maybe it might be a bad metaphor for certain psychologists, especially coaches, and even more trainers maybe. But yeah, I mean, as you said, not every problem should be solved with coaching. I mean, it's preposterous. It's just now fashionable, and everyone just trying to be fashionable. And it's not about fashion, it's about well-being, I guess, results.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just adding on top that this is problem not of just agile coaches,
yeah,
but that we should not be afraid nowadays to tell something, to direct people. Doesn't matter,
yes,
in which role, whether we are an engineer, manager, agile coach, whoever.
Exactly.
On the other hand, sometimes, of course, there is a balance, but then full delegation and giving people space to find the answer, but giving the answers, it's still a tool which is necessary and which shouldn't be lost.
So let's go to a different topic. So basically what we're discussing, it's advanced level, I think. So for managers, trainers, to be able to contract properly, to ask proper questions, understand where you should be a facilitator, where you should be a coach. It's like a meta knowledge that you usually gather through training, especially experience, right? And that main experience is working with yourself, working with your own self, your own demons, your own problems. If you are not aware that you have a pushy quality about yourself, it probably will affect your contracting ability, your ability to listen. If you are not aware that you were bullied, let's say, you might be unaware of your skepticism about people, your insecurities, and your project, Tech Kinship. I think it's trying to work from the bottom up. It's trying to work on the root cause, try to help people be more aware of their emotions, try to help them address these emotions in those difficult conversations. I think it's like that core foundational work that should have been done if we haven't been occupied by Soviet Union or Russian Empire in the past. And now we have to like bootstrap ourselves from that. So when we talk about tech kinship, and we talk about the future of our tech community in Lithuania, maybe in the world in general. So what's like the end goal for this, what you're doing? How would you describe the vision?
So our vision is that anyone across the globe in our tech community, that it's so mature and so diverse. Just a second. I will mute myself until my...
You were in the director mode, right?
Yes, I was in the mode telling that no, you cannot. I will not unlock your iPad and send you all the games. And now please, as we agree, follow our agreement. And it's not an iPad time now. I was in the directive mode. So coming back to tech kinship. So our end goal is actually to make sure that in the community we have place for everyone, and that every person, doesn't matter what kind of role or background he/she has a place where we can grow each other professionally and emotionally. Because right now, lots of focus is put on being professional, but a big part of professional is being emotional, and those are things not really separable. And what we understand that true diversity, it starts from inclusion and getting the point that sometimes there is no such straightforward answer and understanding why the certain things happen. It's not even that I should not be okay if someone is shouting at me, or that I'm not okay that I'm being bullied, but as well to understand why the people who sometimes do that, how, where it's coming from, like what are their emotions, because sometimes it's easier to help other people to change or point it out or grow together when you don't have just anger and blocking reaction, but just helping them to understand. Because for me, one of very interesting examples was the lady who was sharing actually that all her life she was being treated as too emotional, but emotional not in that sad sense when you are very vulnerable. But on the other hand, she has lots of energy and she is being considered as angry or pushy or like those emotions which are, let's say, so making feel you uncomfortable in the sense that you're like feel like being pushed. And she was sharing that when she gets lots of such feedback, and then she comes like very focused, not to show any. She seems to others even madder, even worse, even more angry. And when you listen to her story, you kind of understand what's behind that. When and then next time when she shows some of the emotion, you don't look at, you don't think anymore that it's about you, but just you're like putting, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this level, and because I feel, and it helps to regulate. So the whole initiative is about helping to have conversations about the topics and not to put right or wrong, but understand where it's coming from, how it's called, what's happening with each person. For example, next time we have about the parenting, and we already had such a discussions event, even didn't ever happen. But there is now a push that every man who doesn't go on parental leave feels bad, like, oh no, you are, I don't know, harming your lady and not allowing to make her career choices. On the opposite, some of the women who return back to work after a few months, they are being judged that you're like, you're not a mother, kid needs a child. And actually, when you hear for all those stories, you understand that there are so many solutions for the same question, that there is no right or wrong, and there is no single solution for all the problem. And that's exactly the vision of Tech Kinship, is to help people build the competences, to help people understand what's going on with me, how do I assess what's going on with me, should I go for help. And even in almost in each of the session, we talk that it's okay to go to therapy, and that every person is advised to go to therapy in a certain point to understand things about himself or herself. So yeah, for us it's more starting to legitimize even the conversation about emotions.
Yeah, got
and
it.
That if I talk to you as a leader, that I say like, Pavly, you know, I feel that I'm being burnout. I want to have that conversation. Am I? And what should I do with that?
Yeah.
And that it would be a normal conversation between manager and employee.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Okay. So essentially what I'm hearing is when I was listening to, I was thinking about the concept of emotional intelligence. And the way I understand emotional intelligence is usually like from theory, these are four things. So one thing is understanding your own emotions, your own experience. Then understanding the experience of others, others' emotions. And then being able to use this information to manage relationships, essentially. And what I'm doing mostly in my practice is oftentimes about understanding one's emotions. And I think it's like a very also foundational for being able to express them. And oftentimes the problem is that we start with expression without starting with ourselves. So I think that in Tech Kinship, it seems that you're trying to go from different angles. For people who don't know, these are like certain events that you organize, and they are somewhat experiential because people can participate as well. It's not that it's a, you know, panel discussion where only talking experts talking people can participate in different ways. You also told me that you try to use a different concept for every event, which is also amazing. Now, I still see that we have some time, and it's something that I wanted to talk to you before our conversation. So if after this bit we will say that it's inappropriate, I will cut it and maybe leave it for future premium members of this podcast, but still I would like to discuss this topic and the topic, if it's okay for you. So the topic is diversity and inclusion. And I would like to tell you a short story that happened recently. So in one of my podcasts, with one of the conversational partners, guests, we were talking about the representation of men and women, or male identified or female identified people in the tech community. We didn't use the word identified, we used men, women. And my idea was that in this particular complex world like today, male and female are more like personality concepts, like introversion, maybe extroversion, dichotomous personality concepts, that they better be integrated in yourself to be successful in your work life and personal life. So feminine or masculine, these are connotative terms that carry certain stereotypes, and some are good, some are bad. But basically, according to Jung, if you are able to integrate them, if you're being able to be soft and harsh when you need to, when you're able to, I don't know, care about people as well as about things, you will be more successful. And when I was discussing that, I feel so innocent. I felt that now I'm talking like a feminist and I'm saying correct things that I believe in, and I actually believe in them. And after, and my guest also, he's a man, he's a male identified heterosexual white man. He also didn't seem worried about that. And after that conversation, I got feedback that the way I was describing this bit, it was not inclusive. And the reason it was not inclusive, because I was talking about males and females without addressing that there are people who are non-binary. And I see this as a mistake on my part, because indeed there are people who don't identify with these, in my understanding, psychological understanding, stereotypical dichotomous personalities. And in my view, non-binary is about that Jung idea, but nevertheless, for that person who gave feedback, it seemed not inclusive. And when I looked at certain of your events, you talked about, let's say, they cry like they men, and they like women in Lithuania, it's like different pronouns. They men cry, women shout, or maybe what men should not do or what they should do, what are the stereotypes. And then I thought that after getting that feedback, man, that also seemed not inclusive in that idea, because we're not talking about people who do not identify with these qualities. And then I had this discussion that, okay, what is diversity inclusion? What are these concepts, and what is the correct way to go about them? What is good, what is not good? And then I look back at what is going on in the States, where these discussions are especially sensitive and people get into trouble for, in a sense, innocent first wave feminist thinking, which is, according to some people, dated, and it's already not okay. So that's the difficult question now. And as I said, we will be able to cut it if you don't feel okay. Would you say that for this particular reason, tech kinship is not inclusive enough?
I'd say I don't see this like this, because even our events, they aim to, in their namings, to be opposite to the major stereotypes and to address them, because like women shouts, man cries, it's actually usually we tell differently that it's like men who shout.
I don't know, just stop again.
Yeah, and I understand that there is no binary there, for me it's we still think in the concept more in tech kinship, the way you describe that there are some masculine energy or whatever behaviors and feminine. And yes, it's historically like that. And even here, we're so far away from understanding that that's where we start. And you can tell that maybe it's not inclusive, but even in our language, it's hard to include that. very similar is with the job ad. Yesterday I posted, and I posted with the first female description and then man. And we got into the long discussion that according to our language, the regulation, it should be masculine first and then feminine, like ending in the gap. So my honest, like very honest and personal opinion is that we can tell people and get feedback that they're not inclusive. But on the other hand, to help frame that and be inclusive, and it's a learning curve. We're still in this century around discussing how correctly frame masculine and feminine. And this is for our society. It's very new concept at all. So for me, it's a natural curve that we are learning that. I would not be so harsh on that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And when you say society, I mean, depends on how we define society. If we talk about Lithuanian society, that's one thing. But if we talk about global society, that's a totally different thing. And young people or our age people or whatever, we are also affected by trends in our countries, in our, like in the United States, in the United Kingdom, or maybe our English speaking countries. And there are certain trends where, for example, certain even language constraints are put, for example, in Canada to use certain pronouns to address people. And, you know, there is room for that opinion, I guess, according to a certain group of people, that Lithuanian language is sexist in this particular manner. And now, if we want to be inclusive, we should look for workarounds. And I understand that if we are on a learning curve, it would be maybe unnatural to go straight to the modernist point. And there is arguments to be made by conservative people, but there are people who say that, okay, if it's a trend somewhere, it should be a trend in our country. And in a way, talking about a male versus female, what should men do, what should female do, it might seem maybe modern, like first wave feminist thinking, but for some people it might be already old-fashioned and outdated, you know. And it goes also about, you know, not only gender identity, but any other identity that is not represented properly, maybe in our society, in our country. So, you know, it's not like an advice or something, but it would be interesting one day in Tech Kinship to see this topic also addressed about sexuality, gender identity. It would be great to hear people who also maybe also are LGBTQ plus members, it's strange, or maybe who identify with this particular acronym, and hear their side, you know, and what they would say about men and females and where they put themselves in these discussions. And I think it would be also very inclusive, but not from the idea that to play the political correctness card. And the way I phrased political correctness card for some people might seem derogatory. So I follow American culture, and it's a bit different story over there, but I'm very mindful that, and saying very clearly that I'm an open-minded person and I tolerate towards anyone. At the same time, for me, inclusion and diversity is about making mistakes and learning from them and being curious and not following a certain strict way of speaking or not speaking, you know. And because your community is working with not comfortable topics, I think this is one of those elephants that could be addressed. And I'm sure that there would be very interesting discussions and very open discussions.
Yeah, we will have events actually even this year about being different. And you can be different in many ways. It's about having identifying yourself as binary, or it could be being the one on the team who has some disease, very serious illness. It could be the one being from abroad. and working with the team who are all native speaker. So we plan such event. What I noticed with the women go somewhere and women do something events, that they do not create inclusion. Actually, they create competition and they strengthen and usually that particular group identity, like myself as being a woman. And why we did tech kinship, not women and something? Because I said that in my in this community, in my community, which I plan to create and establish together with others, they will not be a word women. Why? Because it's already like, would you go? But who would welcome men? Yeah, would you go to the meeting called Gentlemen's Club? No. Why? Because you don't expect that you belong there.
Yeah.
So all those namings were fighting for their rights. They are very good in certain stage, but later on, with our community, we seek to build bridges. And that's why I am maybe more change my tone as well, because I was the one who was previously too more inclusive in that terms, that every other gender feels uncomfortable as well. When, for example, we say like men do something against women, or real men don't do that. And this topic was about like that there is no such thing as real men, and there are so many expectations put on them, that we wanted to dedicate an event to show how complex nowadays to be a man, actually, because you have so many expectations to be the one who actually had all those, I don't know, capabilities of 15th century, like to be strong, to be decisive, to fight, like, I don't know, to bring home the elephant and so on.
Yeah, but they are now women who are the same as well.
Exactly. On the other hand, we expect from men as well to be very empathic, with lots of empathy, very caring, help at home, raise kids. So it's actually all those expectations which used to be, and then all the new qualities on top. And then it's like, hey, hello, it's hard as well. So I always encourage to look what's behind the idea, not how we phrase that, and be like even educate us how to phrase that inclusively to everybody.
Yeah,
because it's natural that, of course, we're all learning, and I would even have a hard time to phrase that in the correct way sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's the most important part, being mindful of what we're doing, why we're doing, as we discussed previously, and the why is important, and being open to mistakes and saying incorrect things, and that's how we learn, and maybe some people might disagree that we should get it right immediately, but that's, I think, an illusion. So I see that our time is running out, Alona. So as a final note, Mary, a bit briefly, and I will want to talk to you a bit after our conversation, because we will have to discuss, we want to include that bit. So what would be your final suggestion to people, final remark, final wisdom you might provide? What would it be like in a few sentences?
Very easy question. on the all things which we talked about, I'd say that being very conscious about your emotion, whatever causes your emotions, whether it's some agile coach or diversity topics, so, or anything, to understand what are the topics which hit you harder than others, as well catch the words where you usually associate yourself with being something you don't like to. For example, in Lithuanian, I catched myself that when I tell, oh, well, I will do that, nu gerai. So it's actually usually my way, and I would say 90% of people way of telling that, okay, I will do that, but I don't like that. And to catch such words and at least understand that you're doing a favor, actually, you're not doing something you're willing. Or when I say, well, I'm used to it, I can do that again. And used to it is usually we're used more to beating rather than something nice. So to try to figure out in your vocabulary, because words are very strong things, what are the words which tells you that you're doing something against your will? And especially in these times when we have record high, all times high stress levels at work, be very conscious about the things which add to your battery and which removes your battery, about the topics which help you actually feel better, or on the other hand, make you feel much worse, and be very conscious in these days about your personal well-being, because lots of people were lost behind the team concept, because sometimes there is a feeling that team is some unit which we measure in organizations, and I don't know, happiness, setup, and engagement rating, but the team is a composition of individuals. And even though we have managers, agile coaches who works with the teams a lot as well, at the end of the day, it's each of us accountability to take care about ourselves, to voice what's wrong with us, to be conscious about what we do with this. And it's organizations are not about the teams at the end of the day, they are about personalities, and that each of us has accountability for our personality level and speak up what's not working.
Organizations are about personalities, and each one of us have accountability. Amen. I would like to say here, thanks, Alona, for being here. It was a wonderful time. I hope you enjoyed it as well. I hope to see you here as well once again in the future. There's still ground to cover. I think we covered like 40% of that. But still, thank you, Alona, that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
See you next time.
See you.